Welcome to Talking History, and the last show in our four-part series on the myth of the gunfighter in the American West. This is your host, Brian Lebeau of Creighton University's Department of History. In a moment, we'll be speaking to Robert Utley about Billy the Kid, whose short and violent life is the source of many myths. We'll also be hearing from Hal Rothman on tourism in the Old West. But first, let's look back at this week in history. On January 26, 1784, in a letter to his daughter, Benjamin Franklin expressed unhappiness over the nation's choice of the eagle as its symbol. Franklin wanted the turkey. After signing the Declaration of Independence, the Continental Congress appointed a committee, including Thomas Jefferson, John Adams, and Ben Franklin, to choose a design for the national seal. Jefferson had no strong feelings on the matter, but Adams favored the eagle, whose great strength and daring and courage rendered it an appropriate symbol for the nation. Franklin objected, noting that the eagle was also a predator and a scavenger. The turkey, he added, was a more respectable bird and a true native of America. He was a bird of courage who would not hesitate to attack an entire regiment of British guards who should presume to invade his farmyard. The committee could not decide, and it took until 1782 for Congress to make up its mind, and when it did, of course, it chose the bald eagle. Turning to items of historical interest in the news, archaeologists have found six frozen mummies of people sacrificed to Inca gods more than 500 years ago on a snow-capped volcano in Peru's southern Andes. The well-preserved mummies were found in two graves buried with ceremonial pots, gold and silver statues, and cloth blankets near the crater of El Misti volcano 500 miles southeast of Lima. The Incas, whose empire covered most of the Andes along South America's western coast in the 16th century, practiced human sacrifice to appease their gods. And, horror of horrors, at least for the French, a researcher has found evidence that champagne, the pride of France, was invented by the British. Tom Stevenson has discovered a report written by a British scientist on the making of sparkling wine that was presented to the British Royal Society in 1772, 20 years before the legendary blind French monk Dom Perignon was said to have perfected the method of creating champagne. No word yet from the French on Stevenson's discovery. You're listening to Talking History. In our series on the Old West, we've talked about the lives of gunfighters and the myths and legends we've created around them, about our obsession with making heroes out of killers. In particular, we've taken up the lives and legends of Jesse James and Wyatt Earp. Today we turn to Billy the Kid, whose highly romanticized life in novels, films, and television programs has left us little knowledge of the man, or kid, himself. Here to help us better understand Billy the Kid is Robert Utley, one of the country's most prominent Western historians. He's the author of several books, including High Noon and Lincoln, Violence on the Western Frontier, and Billy the Kid, A Short and Violent Life, both published by the University of Nebraska Press. Welcome, Robert.
Well, thank you for inviting me on.
It's good to have you. Let me ask you immediately, just how exaggerated is the myth of Billy the Kid?
Very, very exaggerated. Well, actually, we're dealing with a multi-layered mythology that covers up a real man somewhere way down beneath. So it is a very large legend.
He led a very short life. How old was he when he died?
21 years old.
And yet we have all these legends that surrounded him along the way?
Precisely.
Can you give me a couple examples of where you think the legend was greatly exaggerated from the life?
Well, he's portrayed in many persona as a psychopathic killer who killed 21 men, one for each year of his short and violent life. And that's one of the most accepted legends about the kid that we have. Of course, it simply isn't true.
How many did he kill?
The other major legend is that he was the captain of an outlaw gang one of 50 or 60 men. Well, he was the captain of nothing. He was kind of a two-bit outlaw himself.
Yeah. Well, how many people did he kill?
Well, there you get into a numbers game. He killed one-on-one four men. He participated in the killing of five more. In other words, other people had their bullets in the victims, too, and almost certainly at least one of the bullets came from Billy's Winchester. And then there is one sixth one about whom we can argue ad infinitum. So, Sheriff Brady, the most spectacular of the victims, had 10 or 12 bullet holes in him. Almost certainly one or two of them came from Billy's rifle, but how do you count that?
Did he kill any lawmen just himself?
Yes, two of the four were lawmen. They were Bob Ollinger and Jim Bell, who were the deputies guarding him when he made his spectacular breakout from the Lincoln County lockout just a few months before his death.
Okay. What was Billy's real name, by the way?
Probably Henry McCarty, and then he became Henry Antrim when his mother married Bill Antrim, and then somewhere along the line, the name of Billy Bonney, he either adopted or it comes from some source yet to be discovered. His early years are the subject of a great deal of research and a great deal of controversy.
Well, what's your interpretation? Where do you think he came from?
I don't know, and the fact is I don't really care. Because he made his name and fame in New Mexico. We can pick him up in New Mexico in 1873 when he was 12 or 13 years old. And it was after that that he becomes very significant. So where he was born and who his parents are simply irritatingly elusive questions that, so far as I'm concerned, the boss can keep on digging for, and I'll be delighted if they discover indisputably where he came from.
Okay.
Most people think Brooklyn, 1859, Irish immigrant.
Oh, my goodness, I'm reminded of the salsa commercial, New York City for a Western outlaw.
Right.
Well, anyway, regardless of where whether we know where he came from, when did his legend start to spread? I mean, if he was that young when he died, he didn't have much time to cultivate much of a following here.
Well, the legend actually burst a few months before he was killed. As I remarked, he was kind of a two-bit outlaw after the Lincoln County War, but the newspapers grabbed hold of his name, Kid, Billy Bonney, and for the first time gave him the name Billy the Kid. This name didn't attach to him until right before his death, and characterized him as the captain of an outlaw gang down on the Pecos River. That's where the legend began. And it drew a good deal of reality and support from the spectacular breakout from the Lincoln County lockup when he killed those two deputies. Then the very dramatic circumstances of his own death at the pistol of Pat Garrett simply exploded all of that newspaper publicity that he had been getting. And you have all of the penny dreadfuls and the pulp thrillers of the time portraying him as a truly vicious outlaw who has finally been brought to justice. But the real basis for the legend comes a year after his death with the publication of Pat Garrett's justification of his role in the death of Billy the Kid. That book really was ghostwritten by someone else who drew most of his inspiration, I think, from a bottle and the fact that he had fleetingly known Billy. So that most of our misinformation about him comes from Pat Garrett's biography, Billy the Kid. After that, it's just a great explosion of literature.
Mm. Well, the Lincoln County War is central. You've mentioned it a couple times, but it's always mentioned in any tale of Billy's life. Can you give me a very brief summary of what happened in the Lincoln County Wars?
Well, it was a very complex contest for monopoly control of the economy of Lincoln County. It's often portrayed as a cattleman's war, which it was not. It was one greedy monopolist being challenged by another greedy guy who wanted to be the monopolist, controlling the government contracts for beef and supplies at Fort Stanton and the Apache Indian Agent. And this simply led to the formation of two armies, both of them contending that they were legal arms of the law. The regulators, with whom Billy the Kid joined up as just, a soldier among older men, gave him, for the first time in his life, a sense of belonging to something, a sense of bonding to other people, men whom he could respect and who came before the war was over to respect him. So this is a kind of a defining 5 months in the life of this kid, and he emerges from it a very skilled, self-confident gunman who has emerged as the leader of the regulator group.
Were there any other dramatic events that we could point to very quickly between the Lincoln County Wars and his death?
Well, the most dramatic one was the breakout from the Lincoln County Jail. The others were, he was simply a two-bit rustler. He had some gunfights that he was involved in, but nothing that would have lifted him above simply the daily newspapers in New Mexico. It was that breakout from the courthouse in Lincoln that made him a national figure and gave him publicity in New York and San Francisco and elsewhere. Then the dramatic circumstances of his death at the hands of Pat Garrett.
Could you tell us just a bit about that?
Well, Garrett was the sheriff of Lincoln County, but also a deputy U.S. Marshal, and he had a whole pocket full of warrants for people who had figured in the Lincoln County War. But Billy the Kid had made himself so conspicuous, or shall we say the newspapers had made him so conspicuous, that he was the prime target. He was, after his breakout, living in one sheep camp after another around old Fort Sumner, an abandoned military post in eastern New Mexico. And Garrett, by just sheer coincidence, sheer accident, happened to be at midnight in the bedroom of Pete Maxwell, asking Pete whether Billy was anywhere around when Billy wandered in. And Garrett was just a fraction of a second quicker than Billy and shot and killed him.
In your earlier remarks in your book, you talk about stripping away the veneer of legends that have accumulated over the years about Billy the Kid. And at the same time, you also refer to him a couple times as a two-bit rustler and a two-bit gunman and whatever. It sounds like when you've stripped everything away, you don't find anything particularly heroic in Billy the Kid.
Well, you're right. You don't find anything heroic in any of those people who figured in the Lincoln County War or its aftermath, including the judge and the district attorney and even the governor of New Mexico, Lew Wallace. There's nothing heroic in any of them. They were products of the Gilded Age, of their time and place on the violent frontier. Billy the Kid was no hero, but he was above the average of the run-of-the-mill gunman. He was a happy-go-lucky kid that everyone liked, always in good humor, sunny, cheerful nature, open, generous. He was always laughing and smiling. He loved music. He liked to dance. And, of course, the Hispanic girls down there went for him in a big way. So he had a personality, and of course he could read and write, so that put him above many of them. So he was a distinctive personality. He was a complex personality. Buried down beneath all of this good humor was a hair-trigger temper that could blow up at any moment. I like to compare this kid just simply to most adolescents. If you've ever had a teenage son, you know that most adolescents are sort of controlled by the impulse of the moment. They are creatures of self-justification. They can justify anything they do as needing to be done. They have very worthy long-range goals, but they just simply can't make much progress toward them because they are creatures of the moment. And this was Billy the Kid. He really did want to go straight, but at any given moment, he couldn't pull himself away from the pleasures of the moment.
How do we take a guy, though, and I'm accepting, you know, everything you say is very interesting, an impulsive young man, great personality, happy-go-lucky, a good ladies' man, perhaps. Why, then, would we select Billy the Kid to make a hero in our Western lore?
I don't think anyone's ever going to come up with the answer to that question. The best way I can respond is to say that there are simply certain figures out of our past that so stir our imaginations for whatever reason that they become, in effect, mirrors, reflections of each succeeding generation, which can mold this figure into a reflection of who they are in values and attitudes and so forth, so that the persona of Billy the Kid changes from generation to generation as the values and the attitudes and the outlook on life as those succeeding generations change. That's why the movie image of Billy changes so radically from the 30s to the 60s to the 80s. What's happening is that Billy is being molded into who we are at that particular time. He serves a purpose. General Custer serves the same purpose, and you see exactly the sort of thing there. Why people choose certain figures and not other figures, I don't know. It's a very strange thing, but I know that Billy is one of those who reflects the people who are looking at him at any given time and place, and therefore what is seen tells more about who's doing the looking than it does who's being looked at.
Well, that's been our theme all along, and I think you summarized it very well, and perhaps we ought not to go beyond that. So we're out of time. Thank you very much. It was a great interview.
You're very welcome.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
You've been listening to Robert Utley, author of Billy the Kid, A Short and Violent Life, published by the University of Nebraska Press. Welcome back to Talking History. For our historic site of the week, following up on our discussion of Billy the Kid, we've picked a place long associated with Billy, Lincoln, New Mexico. Here to tell us about Lincoln is Talking History's Cindy Workman.
Lincoln, New Mexico is a town caught in time. The main street is still lined with adobe houses and commercial buildings that date back to the 19th century. There are no gas stations or convenience stores in Lincoln, and only one public phone. Billy the Kid lore is the most well-known aspect of the town. An annual pageant during the first weekend in August includes a fiddler's contest, as well as a reenactment of the kid's famous escape from the courthouse. The Turnstall Store, where the leader of the legendary Lincoln County War factions had his business, still displays the 19th century merchandise on its shelves.
Jesse James, Wyatt Earp, Billy the Kid, they're all gone, and all we have left are their legends and the tourism their memories and historic sites generate. For this week's op-ed, we've invited Hal Rothman to talk about tourism and the Old West. Hal Rothman, professor of history at the University of Nevada at Las Vegas, is the author of Devil's Bargains, Tourism in 20th Century American West, published by the University of Kansas Press.
The West is our national creation myth, the genesis of the modern American Republic. Born anew from the ashes of the Civil War, the nation remade itself free of the flaws of the First Republic. That first United States, the one that lasted from the Declaration of Independence to the shelling of Fort Sumter, had fissures in it as deep and wide as the crack in the Liberty Bell itself. The Civil War created a new nation, one that left behind the turmoil of sectionalism. The new nation solved the problem inherent in the title of the nation. It made the word united more important than the word states. That is why we revere the Western experience, why it is so central to our being. Time and again, we look west for renewal. We see ourselves in its reflection. We draw on it to define ourselves. The West is the story we use to define who we've become. From John Wayne to The Ballad of Little Joe, a movie about a woman who lives her life as a man in the 19th century West, the West tells us who we are. No wonder, then, tourists by the millions crave Old Tombstone, Dodge City, and even the Pony Express station in Gothenburg, Nebraska. These places tell us of our origins as a nation, of the mythological stories that shaped us and gave us the power to make the 20th century the American century. We flock to these places to renew ourselves, in search of affirmation of ourselves, our choices, and the direction of our society. Even the most hackneyed of them is real to us, very real. These places tell us of ourselves. Of course, the people in these towns make their attractions into what we want them to be. There's no real West out there anymore, if there ever was. The visited, as they're called, have learned over time that we pay better and stay longer if we have a good time, which means that we visitors feel like the story revolves around us. We find ourselves in a script in which we don't quite star, but that we certainly narrate. The gunfights, the saloons, the imagery of the region, from black-hatted cowboys to dancing girls, even the rodeos, which used to be for the locals, are staged for the visitor as a source of revenue for people in their places. The visited hold up a mirror to us. When we see ourselves in it as we want to be, we're charmed. We smile, we write the check, and we come back. For the people of these places, tourism is a devil's bargain. Like mining and other extractive industries, tourism is colonial at its core. Taking the copper or gold from your landscape has its price, but sometimes it's even harder to sell your identity than what's in your dirt. Tourism challenges identity, making places that look the same but are frozen in a fictitious moment in the past. Here's where we are at the end of the 20th century. We look west to make ourselves whole, but find a packaged experience designed to make a myth awaiting us. But it feels good, even if it isn't always what we expected, and so we sign on, embracing a path that we've made from our needs. That's why the West endures in our mythology. It has the ability to tell us we're better than we think, and often know we are.
You've been listening to Hal Rothman, author of Devil's Bargains, Tourism in the 20th Century American West, published by the University of Kansas Press. Finally, we turn to our weekly list of coming attractions of a historical nature. The Billy the Kid Outlaw Gang, a nonprofit organization whose purpose is to preserve, protect, and promote Billy the Kid and Pat Garrett history in New Mexico, will hold its annual campout July 15th through the 18th at Cedar Creek Campgrounds on the northwest edge of Ruidoso, New Mexico. For further details, contact the Billy the Kid Outlaw Gang in Capitan, New Mexico. And for those of you who prefer the good guys, the Gene Autry Oklahoma Film and Music Festival, dedicated to the singing cowboys of B-Westerns, will be held on September 24th through the 26th at the Gene Autry Museum in Gene Autry, Oklahoma. Contact the museum for further information. And that's it for another week of Talking History. I hope you've enjoyed our program and that you'll join us next week when we will talk about pirates, the romance, and the reality. In the meantime, we invite you to send us your comments or suggestions either by email at talkinghistory@creighton.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at Creighton University in Omaha, Nebraska, 68178. Until next time, from the studios of KIOS-FM in Omaha, Nebraska, this is Brian LeBeau.
Happy trails to you, until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling, Uncle Ben. Who cares about the clouds if we're together? Just sing a song and bring the sunny weather. Happy trails to you. Till we meet.